is Monday, July the 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, more deadly attacks in Germany. Plus, the U.S. Democratic Party holds its national election this week.
It's all going to culminate on Thursday when Hillary Clinton, we expect her to accept the nomination and become the first woman for a major party contender to run for president.
Also ahead, a ruling from the Olympics involving Russia, plus singer-songwriter Selena Gomez, a big hit on social media. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. An explosion killed at least one person. That's the attacker, a 27-year-old Syrian refugee, and injured numerous others near the German city of Nuremberg on Sunday. It was the fourth violent incident in Germany in a week and came as the country is still on edge after the killing of nine people by an 18-year-old Iranian gunman in Munich on Friday. Also Sunday, a 21-year-old Syrian refugee was arrested after killing a pregnant woman, injuring two other people. That was near Stuttgart. That attack came after a refugee from Pakistan used an axe to injure five people near Würzburg, also in southern Germany, before he was shot and killed by police on July the 18th. For some perspective about all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Deakin University scholar Greg Barton.
Look, it's a terrible, terrible time for Germany. It's not all one thing. As best we can tell, there's a variety of motives. The Munich shooter was certainly interested in mass killings. He researched that. He was particularly drawn to Anders Behring Breivik, the Norwegian terrorist who 5 years to the day prior had shot dead 69 people on the island of Victoria, having already blown up eight people in the capital, Oslo. It may well be that some of the right-wing extremist ideology of Breivik influenced Ali Sonboy, Somboli, the shooter in Munich, but that's not clear. He identified with him. The motive is important because in the case of Breivik, we can define that as right-wing terrorism. In the case of Munich, it's not clear. This attack in the last few hours in Ansbach, it looks like it was deliberate. It looks like it may have even been premature. A backpack IED blowing up on the person carrying it near the entrance to a music festival. Possibly the person was trying to go inside and detonate there. But beyond that, it's hard to say. But that looks more likely because of the nature of the attack, or at least the nature of the incident with improvised explosive device, to be something that's politically motivated and therefore terrorism. The horrible machete killing seems to be somebody who's disturbed and acting out in anger. It's not clear that there was a motive there. And similarly with the Pakistani teenager in the axe attack on the train, it's not clear what motive is there either. There's the possibility we're dealing with a combination of some incidents that are driven by people with mental health issues and other incidents that may have some sort of political inspiration. It doesn't seem, however, that any of these incidents at this stage have links with Islamic State, which is very significant given that's the major threat at the moment.
The Munich teenager is described as a loner who was obsessed with playing killer video games, a victim of bullying, was being treated or had been treated for depression and psychiatric problems. Anything can be done to combat this kind of attack?
Well, Germany, of course, is asking itself what it should do about its gun laws. This teenager purchased his pistol, his Glock pistol, through the dark web, through that hidden section of the internet used for criminal transactions. But police are trying to see whether that could be helped. I think the more obvious line of inquiry is to see what could be done with mental health interventions, and that's a struggle in every country. No country gets this completely right. Clearly, his propensity or capacity for violence was not fully diagnosed. Otherwise, there would have been other interventions in place. It obviously caught his family by surprise, his neighbours by surprise. It'll be interesting to hear what doctors have to say. It does raise the question of whether there shouldn't be more attention paid through autonomous algorithms, web bots, to people's browsing history to raise a red flag when people are looking up dangerous material. That raises all sorts of civil liberty questions, but I think that's a question we're going to be hearing discussed directly in the months to come.
Greg, will this have any impact on Germany's immigration policy vis-a-vis the people coming in from North Africa, the Middle East, and South Asia?
As of this moment, it probably isn't going to tip the balance, but if we see these attacks like this, I mean, and bearing in mind there's all sorts of motives, all sorts of different attacks, but if we see ongoing series of attacks linked to people who were born to families that have migrated to Germany years ago or have recently come with asylum seeker applications. It is going to play into the political anxiety that grips the whole of Europe, not just Germany. So Germany is robust, and so far it's able to handle this, but any more of these sort of incidents, and there's no way that this issue won't become a live matter of political debate. It's interesting in the case of the Munich shooter, the people he shot were mostly teenagers, mostly his own peers, and not just in age were they his peers. He posed online in a false Facebook post as a Turkish teenage girl, offering people to meet up at McDonald's for free meals. And the people he shot, and he shot very accurately, he killed people very effectively by all accounts, so he was aiming very specifically. The people he shot were mostly teenagers from migrant families, from, in many cases, Muslim families. So he seems to have had certain issues with his own identity, and that's something that has to be discussed. I think this deeply, deeply worries the Germans, and any more incidents that involve migrants or asylum seekers are going to make it very hard for them to do the things that they want to do.
That's Greg Barton, a terrorism expert at Deakin University in Melbourne, Australia. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beattie. And later in the program, Vic will be back to speak with an expert about the Olympics and doping. Among the other stories we're staying on top of here at The Voice of America, Turkish ruling and opposition parties had a joint rally and show of unity, Nepal's prime minister resigning, South Sudan's president urged not to violate the peace accord. Expanded coverage of those stories a lot more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. And now we take our reporting to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where the Democratic Party this week will hold its national convention to nominate Hillary Clinton as its candidate for president. Just in the last day or so, what promised to be a smooth nominating process has taken a turn. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who was Clinton's opponent throughout the primary season, has demanded that the head of the Democratic Party's National Committee step down following WikiLeaks disclosing emails from Democratic Party leaders reportedly showing favoritism for Clinton over Sanders. VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone joins us now to talk about all of this. Jim, things now appear to be fractured a bit going into the convention.
They are, and those tensions were dormant for quite a while leading up to the convention. But then we had this surprise release of emails. Now we have bad blood between the Democratic National Committee and the Sanders campaign, which also goes back several months. Then we have Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the controversial chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee, who's going to be stepping down now over this furor. Yeah, you're right. It's interesting. The Democrats were anticipating a much more unified meeting than the Republicans had, but their issues are coming up to be a problem, and it looks like they're going to have to spend the next few days taking care of business at home before they can move on to, you know, putting Hillary Clinton out as the nominee and focusing more on Donald Trump.
We've learned since you and I spoke last that Tim Kaine, the senator from the state of Virginia, is her choice to be her vice presidential running mate. They've already been out campaigning some in Florida and various places. People are saying that's a good choice. He's a perfect fit.
He appears to be a good choice in many ways. He was a top contender when Barack Obama was looking for a running mate 8 years ago. So he's been through this mill before. Now, in the next few days, I want to talk to some of the delegates here. I want to find out from not only the Clinton people, but the Sanders supporters, what they think of Tim Kaine. There's some question among some of the progressives that his liberal record is not as strong as they would like. There were other people talked about, like Elizabeth Warren and some other figures who had more of a liberal reputation in the party, which would have been pleasing to the Sanders coalition. So we're going to have to see how Tim Kaine is received. But generally, I think he's seen as a competent pick and seems to be someone who meshes very well with Hillary Clinton. And, you know, that may be a key reason why he was chosen. She has said she's looking for someone to be a partner in government, if and when they are elected.
And, of course, by this time next week, both the nominees will be out there. Donald Trump from the Republican Party, along with his vice presidential running mate, Governor Pence, and we'll have Clinton and Kaine. And then the real action begins, huh?
Yeah, it does. But I noticed that Donald Trump has a number of events this week. He's going to be speaking pretty much every day. And you know what, Steve? I mean, this is amazing. We used to have this sort of this political etiquette here where one party has its convention, the focus is on them, the other party kind of hangs back, and then, you know, the reverse is true the next week. Well, with Donald Trump especially, you know, you can throw the rule book out the window. So he's going to be talking every day, probably about the Democrats. He's already been tweaking the Sanders supporters now about whether they should stick with Hillary Clinton. So the general campaign is going to be fought on at the same time as the Democrats kind of take the focus on the national spotlight and put it on Hillary Clinton by the end of the week. And don't forget some of the other luminaries speaking this week, Bill Clinton, the former president, and we're going to have, of course, President Obama later in the week as well. So the Democrats have some heavy hitters to come up, but it's all going to culminate on Thursday when Hillary Clinton, we expect her to accept the nomination and become the first woman for a major party contender to run for president. So it's going to be, there's going to be some history made in Philadelphia, and it's a city that's used to history being made.
And many thanks to you, Jim. VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone speaking with us from Philadelphia. Jim just mentioned Philadelphia's familiarity with history being made. Well, that's the city that played an instrumental role in the American Revolution as the place where the Declaration of Independence from England was signed in 1776, and the Constitution of the United States was adopted there in 1787. And as Jim Malone just mentioned, the head of the Democratic Party National Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, is stepping down over this email matter. That's creating quite a bit of buzz on social media. My colleague, G. Abby Lee, is here with all the latest. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. This is not the news Schultz had been waiting for on the eve of the Democratic National Convention. She's on Twitter at DWS Tweets, but hasn't tweeted about WikiLeaks or her resignation yet. The main Twitter account to follow in this story is WikiLeaks verified account at WikiLeaks. It sent out dozens of tweets in the last 24 hours and retweeted many media reports on its latest findings. Some of the original tweets are elaborations. Here's an example. Hashtag DNC leak. WikiLeaks chose a publishing date. As usual, we published as soon as the documents were verified and as fast as resources permitted. Another one reads like this. Broadcasters so far implicated in hashtag DNC leaks. MSNBC, CBS. Broadcasters so far not covering hashtag DNC leaks, MSNBC, CBS. In a particular tweet sharing a link to the more than 19,000 leaked emails, it also used hashtag Hillary2016 and hashtag feel the burn.
Okay, G, moving on to the responses, what's the Sanders group tweeting about it?
Absolutely nothing so far, but GOP nominee Donald Trump had a lot to tweet, and he did. One of his many tweets on the issue reads like this. Sorry, folks, but Bernie Sanders is exhausted. Just can't go on any longer. He's trying to dismiss the new emails and DNC disrespect. Sad. Within 8 hours, more than 22,000 people liked that tweet.
Are there any other reactions?
Here's a popular tweet from Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers. Her handle is at rweingarten, and she wrote this. Much of the content of DNC leaks was inappropriate, full stop. As a DNC member, I sincerely apologize to Bernie Sanders for this behavior. Steve, back to you.
And many thanks to you, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. And as always, you can find G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can find our program, International Edition, on Twitter at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
Next time on Street Talk Africa. Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the Democratic National Convention and what a Hillary Clinton presidency could mean for Africa. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA's International Edition. International Olympic Committee has decided against banning all Russian teams from competing in next month's Rio Olympics over allegations of an elaborate doping scheme. IOC's decision has brought some immediate negative response from the anti-doping agencies, as well as others. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Ed Hula, editor and founder of the website AroundTheRings.com, which reports on the business and politics of the Olympics, for his read on all of this.
Well, it is the IOC trying to walk a fine line between sanctioning everybody, keeping out Russia from Rio, which would be a very drastic, difficult situation for the IOC, or figuring out a way to allow one-by-one athletes to be able to go to Rio and compete. What they have created is a very complicated, difficult-to-implement procedure here that requires the 300-and-something Russian athletes who are supposed to compete in Rio. They're going to have to prove themselves worthy from the drugs point of view, from the doping point of view, in order to be competing in Rio. And they've only got a little more than a week to get this all done. Russia is a very powerful partner of the Olympic movement. They host sports events, world championships, Winter Olympic Games, for example. The World Cup is coming up in 2018. IOC members are from Russia, important country for sport. And that's why the IOC finds it very difficult, a bit reluctant, to just throw out the Russians entirely from the Rio Olympics.
If this had been another country, would it have been a different story?
Could have been. If, you know, a smaller, less politically influential country might have not been able to, you know, withstand the pressure, not been able to put pressure towards the IOC as well. You know, the Russians have Vladimir Putin. Not many other nations have that kind of head of state who has a personal relationship with the IOC president.
Well, on the face of it, the IOC seems to have delivered a fair ruling, given the fact that not all athletes necessarily are engaged in such activity. What do you make of that?
Well, that is the idea of protecting clean athletes, and it's really the right way to do it. If you're not guilty of doping, why should you be treated just like those who have? And that's, you know, what the IOC wants to be able to do is bring these clean athletes to Rio de Janeiro, all keeping out the dirty ones.
Here's a quote from the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. Many, including clean athletes and whistleblowers, have demonstrated courage and strength in confronting a culture of state-supported doping and corruption within Russia. Disappointingly, however, in response to the most important moment for clean athletes and the integrity of the games, the IOC has refused to take decisive leadership. Is that a fair statement?
That is what they want, that kind of death penalty, if you will, for a country that flagrantly violates doping laws. And the IOC just apparently doesn't want to go that far because they feel they will penalize the clean athletes. The national anti-doping organizations like the United States, Canada, around the world, are definitely in favor of this strict punishment for the Russians. The National Olympic Committees, the actual teams that will be coming to Rio, are a little bit less harsh, and they are siding with the IOC on this, as well as the international sports federations. So you've got a real division, I think, in the Olympic movement between those who really think there should be harsh punishment for the Russians, and that includes many IOC members, some of whom are actually Olympians. And so those plus Olympians who will be going to Rio de Janeiro, I think, want more out of this than the IOC has delivered. And I think we have interesting times ahead as the IOC tries to reconcile this decision with the those who think they hadn't gone far enough.
Well, this is just one of a number of controversies surrounding the Rio Games. As you know, the bad water, slow in building the infrastructure. You have the Zika virus.
And today we open the Olympic Village in Rio de Janeiro with the news that the Australian Olympic team refuses to stay in the village until they get things fixed. Exposed wiring, leaking plumbing, toilets that won't flush, other unfinished business in the Olympic Village that's supposed to be ready for occupancy today. It just doesn't stop for Rio. They pledge that they'll have everything fixed by the time all the athletes roll into town. But it's just another indication of the difficulty, the challenges that they face, and anybody faces putting on the Olympic Games, whether it's in Rio de Janeiro or London, England.
That is Ed Hula. He is editor and founder of the website AroundTheRings.com, and he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beattie. British cyclist Chris Froome successfully defended his Tour de France title on Sunday and has now won the multi-stage race three times in the past 4 years. Flora Howard Griffin and her husband watched Froome come across the finishing line on Paris's Champs-Élysées.
A machine. Yeah, well, he's won most of the stages, I think, so far. I was here when he won last year as well, so I think you could say he's a machine. He's almost like Lance Armstrong, but without the drugs.
Yeah, lots of shouting for Froome. Kenyan Bourne led more than 4 minutes over Frenchman Romain Bardet heading into the 21st and final, largely ceremonial stage in Paris. Froome vowed that he will be returning to France to try for another win and perhaps take part in the prestigious event five or six more times. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Scientists working with what has been purported to be the world's most sensitive dark matter detector say that despite spending 20 months looking for the mysterious stuff, they have not been able to detect even a single trace of it. The large underground xenon dark matter experiment was conducted at the Sanford Underground Research Facilities located beneath about 1.6 kilometers of earth and rock in the Black Hills of South Dakota. The Lux scientists say their detector was so sensitive that if any dark matter particles had actually interacted with their device, it would have certainly pointed them out. The researchers say their experiment gathered and then later analyzed nearly 500 terabytes worth of data. Findings from the Lux experiment will be used to help those conducted in the future, such as the Lux Zeppelin experiment, which is expected to continue the search for dark matter in 2020. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. You know, to be a superstar in the music business these days, it's just not enough to have a great voice and a whole lot of talent. You have to build a really great social media presence. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald goes right to the top of one of the best examples.
You got me sipping on something I can't compare to nothing.
We are going to be talking about Selena Gomez and her mastery of social media.
And she is all over social media. I saw her on Twitter with a picture of her fans today.
That's right. She really knows how to use social media. And, you know, Jim, you and I, we came up in the 70s and 80s where if you were a musician and you weren't on tour, you were hoping to angle for a nice fat record deal, and that would pretty much pay the bills. But as we know, today album sales are not what they used to be. The album market's pretty much cratered unless your name is Adele or Taylor Swift.
Right.
But you can still make money if you're a savvy musician and you're one of a lucky few. Now, I want to concentrate on Selena Gomez because when it comes to personal branding, she's one of several celebrities, and they're all female, who dominate social media these days. Measurement company DeMarie Analytics just ranked the top social influencers. All of them are women, and Selena is number one. They say that Selena Gomez is worth $550,000 per post.
Wow.
When messaging across Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Selena is the most followed person on Instagram. Right now, she has more than 90 million followers. Now, the CEO of DeMarie Analytics, Frank Spatafora, says that Gomez isn't necessarily getting $500,000 to post. what she is getting is negotiated between her agents and the company she promotes. Mm-hmm. All right, now Selena Gomez has deals with Coca-Cola, Pantene Shampoo, and Kmart stores. Spadafora says one reason she's successful is that she's smart. She's very subtle about how she uses social media to promote these products. She knows that saturating her feeds with promotion could negatively impact her relationship with her fans. She doesn't want to be seen as a shill, so she has fewer contracts than some of her contemporaries. But the advertisers get more mileage out of it mm-hmm. because Selena's fans believe she honestly likes the stuff that she's using. I mentioned that she's the number one person on Instagram. She also has 60 million likes on Facebook and 44 million Twitter followers.
Selena provides a pretty good business model here. Less is more, mm-hmm. as she is very selective about her posting, mm-hmm. and she appears very genuine when she is using these products.
That's right. Selena Gomez has always projected a very likable image. People have watched her grow up. I mean, she was a Disney star when she was a girl. The social media market is evolving. It's very turbulent. It's kind of like the Wild West. It has opportunities, but it also has huge pitfalls.
Lots of opportunities each and every week for you to listen to our Top 20 Countdown with our host, Ray McDonald.
You can hear it Thursdays on VOA 1. And you can also follow me on my Twitter feed at Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
Dear Selena Gomez wants to be good for you, huh? Thanks to Jim Stevenson for that interview with Ray McDonald, and thanks to you for listening to The Voice of America Today, an international edition. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jonah Cummings, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday, everyone.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Once the fighting ends, peace treaties are signed, and armies are disbanded, the world assumes too often that life in former conflict areas will soon return to normal. But leftover landmines and unexploded munitions stand in the way of post-conflict stabilization and inhibit long-term development. They render thousands of hectares of land unusable and destabilize communities. To mitigate long-term damage and help war-ravaged communities move toward a sustainable peace, the United States has, since 1993, provided over $2.6 billion for conventional weapons destruction programs that help to safely clear landmines and explosive remnants of war, such as ammunition, artillery shells, and air-delivered bombs. Still, in many countries, landmines and unexploded ordnance can kill and maim their victims decades after the original conflict is little more than an ugly memory. Completely ridding former battlegrounds of these explosives is, therefore, a long-term project. This effort cannot succeed without building local expertise in partner nations and training leaders that can take control of mine clearance programs in their own countries. The Center for International Stabilization and Recovery at James Madison University in the state of Virginia has for many years conducted management training for leaders in humanitarian mine action around the world. Since 2010, the State Department's Office of Weapons Removal and Abatement has sponsored the course, which seeks to integrate the latest ideas in business management with the practical experience of mine clearance professionals. The goal is to train senior managers of national demining programs to make the programs function more effectively and efficiently. In late spring of this year, the university hosted 21 demining management professionals from Afghanistan, Colombia, Iraq, Laos, Lebanon, Libya, Palau, Senegal, Sri Lanka, Somalia, Tajikistan, Vietnam, and Yemen. They honed their technical and managerial skill, which they will now apply improving their country's capacity to clear contaminated land. The United States is investing in mine and explosives clearance because by doing so, we not only protect civilians from explosive remnants of war, but we also enable lasting peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
is for...